There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live. Live.
All right. It is Friday, January 5th at 5 p.m. and you're listening to CKUT broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at CKUT.ca. We have Off the Hour Fridays today. This is a show hosted by our news collective. And I'm Jules Bigel. I do local news at the station. I'm joined by two news volunteers here. You guys want to introduce yourselves?
Hello, I am Titoan.
And I'm Eliza.
Yeah, so we're starting off the year pretty slow with things on Off the Hour. We've got a couple stories from December, things that, you know, are going to be big on the horizon coming up this year that we want to revisit, you know, relax, get your head back in the news zone, and acquaint you with what matters. How are you guys feeling about the new year? How are things happening over at McGill? Because you guys are both students, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was an early start. We started 2 days ago on the 4th, so it's been busy already trying to figure out classes, which one I want to keep. But it's been fun. It's missing the snow for the winter semester, but
yeah. Climate change rears its ugly head. We don't have anything on that, but I think maybe we should. You know, what's going to happen? We're already seeing it. No white Christmas, and what was it, like warmest Christmas on record in lots of places.
Oh, wow.
But what we do have lined up is a wonderful interview that I did before the holidays with Mark Andrew Hamilton. He's a co-coordinator of an exhibit that's on right now at the Gay Archives of Quebec, and that's on Montreal's queer history. Those archives are celebrating 40 years of existence. Take a listen. Line, Mark Andrew Hamilton, who's co-curator of a new archival exhibition of Quebec's queer history. Mark, you're live on air. Thanks for coming on the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First, can you just share a little bit about yourself and how you came to co-curate this exhibition?
Yeah, I mean, I've been living in Montreal for 8 years. I'm a student of history at Concordia, and I've been studying queer history, and so spending a lot of time down at the archives. And I guess last year I kind of became a volunteer curator of special exhibitions there, and we wanted to commemorate the 40th anniversary of these great archives. So we came up with this show, which I don't know if you said the name on air yet, but it's called Bag QC, which is on Archive Gage of Quebec. And it just opened last week.
Yeah, I didn't say the name on air. I had a roommate once who was very particular about that word. And so, you know, can I say it? It's the name of the exhibition, but I'm glad you said it for me.
Well, it's an acronym.
Yeah.
Yes, it's an acronym, so it's okay.
Yeah, a very artfully chosen acronym. So more about the show. It's a new exhibition sharing 40 artifacts from Quebec's gay community, one for each year of the AGQ's existence. You know, gay community, is that specifically the gay community? Is that the larger LGBTQ+ community?
Yeah, it's plus all over the place. There's many different groups that are represented, and we asked... We spoke to 40 different researchers and friends at the archives. So there's a couple of fellow students, like a really interesting researcher named Devin Gwynn has a piece in the show, as well as Gabrielle Iaconetti. And then we have people like Barbara. We have other people who were firsthand people that were the sex garage raid, and just other people. So there's not one object from each year, but it's just 40 different people that are selecting something. And it kind of gives a broad overview of what's there. And what's surprising for me was that I could have picked 40 things from the collection that I thought were cool. And a lot of those things aren't actually in the show. And there's a lot of things that I've never seen myself. So it's really, really fascinating, actually, what came together and how people view the archives differently.
Yeah, I guess how did people choose the artifacts? Was it all from the Gay Archives of Quebec's archive? Like, you know, were people going in and sort of poring over that? How did that actually work?
Yeah, for the most part, it was people that knew the collections already, that had come there to research certain things. But otherwise, if it was someone like Trana Winter, for example, she selected something for the show, but we sent her several pieces that we thought might be of interest to her and asked which one spoke to her loudest. So there's kind of a range of ways that things were chosen. And some other people they asked to come down and, I guess, talk about their interests. And then the archivist, who's also my curator, I think you would call us like co-coordinators more than curators, because there's 40 curators of the show. But my co-coordinator, Simone Baudry-Pilot, who is the archivist at the Gay Archives, she would kind of guide them towards things that might be of interest. And yeah, people were pretty uniformly quite happy.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can just give me a sense of like what kind of pieces are featured in an archive like this. You know, is it a lot of like print archives, ephemera of that kind? Is it, you know, are there bigger pieces? Like, I just have no idea what that actually could look like in practice. I guess people will have to come down to the show to see everything, but when you're thinking about some of the things that struck you that people chose for the exhibition, like what are some of those?
Well, I think the smallest objects we have are things like little buttons or matchbooks, a collection of matchbooks that's on display, and as big as protest banners that were carried through the streets of Montreal in the 90s. There's these huge paintings that kind of open the show that there's certain objects that we don't even know much about, like those paintings, for example, but they are huge pieces that played some role in the queer history of the city. So there's this big range of stuff. And as for what's in the archives, it's everything from clothing to documents to love letters. Like, there's this one collection of love letters that I particularly love, and it's a one-sided love affair that kind of falls apart. And I think these letters were written in the 60s and 70s. And that's, you know, that sort of thing is there. It's just a huge range of things. It's a very living archive, and it's not just limited to paper.
Yeah. How and why, I guess, did that archive come about all those years ago? You said it's for the 40-year anniversary. What is the story of that, you know, that founding, that creation 40 years ago?
Well, it was founded by a group in Montreal who are still actually, some of them are still active at the Gay Archives, people like Ross Higgins, who just felt like things needed to be commemorated. And I'm not entirely sure if that was kind of in some ways heightened, or I guess clearly it must have been heightened by the HIV/AIDS crisis and this kind of need to commemorate and document people's lives that were here. And it's something that traditionally before that was not documented at all. So it's only because of people like Ross that we even have these things. And it tells, you know, like I was saying before, it sounds like a pretty amazing story of the city and kind of an alternate view of the way people have always lived their lives here, because it's always been quite a vibrant queer city, kind of a collector city. And it's all down there.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when you think about like an institution talking about their 40-year history, you know, you expect something that's like linear, and it's saying, okay, well, there's this big development in this year, and then we opened this wing in like 2012. It's usually that kind of story that's being told, but you're saying, you know, there's all these kind of friends of the archive and prominent queer Montrealers, and they're just picking things that speak to them or their research or caught their fancy. What kind of experience does that give people who are walking into and, I guess, walking through the exhibition?
Well, as we were hanging the show, like, actually my parents came to visit Montreal and they were helping hang the show. And there was a group of us there, so my parents, Simone, myself, Jonathan, who also works at the archives, and we were hanging. And at one point, Simone was just like, what story does this tell? It's not like a cohesive thing. And it's just because we were too far inside of it to really know. So when we had the vernissage the other day, people were actually really quite extremely moved by it. And we received a lot of comments from people. And yeah, it's not a linear story. It's not chronological. It's not There's not like one thing that emerges above any other. Just more kind of like, this is a snapshot, and it's a show that can be done again with, 40 different people, should we choose to do that. It's hard to, I guess, really describe what I thought it would be versus what it actually is when I saw people looking at it, because that makes it a totally different thing.
Yeah, and it also sounds like something that, you know, it could be different with every group of 40 people, but it also could be different with every group of people who are going into the space and experiencing it, right?
Yeah, like, absolutely. I mean, the hope is that there's a lot of groups that are reflected back in it, and then there's, you know, like any sort of show like this, there's certainly things that I think are missing, you know, and there's an opportunity to kind of contemplate what is missing and then seeing how we can kind of address that in future, in terms of like what sort of groups we ask for their archives, or what sort of people we try to engage with, maybe in like a future exhibition, to see like what other sorts of things we can show and bring to the archive and share with people.
Yeah, I guess I'm curious as well about, you know, when people think of Gay Montreal, I'm sure people have different things that come to mind, but at the basic level, you know, there's the history of the village. You know, for people who that's just basically all they know, all they think about, what are some of the things that they can learn about by going to an exhibition like this one?
I guess that it's not just relegated to one neighborhood in the city, and that, like, the idea of a quote-unquote village in Montreal actually has changed location. Like, in the 70s, it was down by Concordia University, and then it kind of made its way over to where it is now. That it's a very vibrant and activist-based scene as well, and that there's a lot of firsts in the city, and there's a lot of firsts in the show as well. Like, we have the first wedding certificate of two people of the same sex in Canada was recognized by the Supreme Court, so that's up on the wall as part of the exhibition. There's the first bar where people of the same sex could dance with one another, called PJs. We have some objects from that. We have some photographs of some, amazing trans people in the 1970s who lived and worked openly in Montreal. So it's quite a, I guess, if your image of Montreal is, its career scene is just the village, there's so much more. You know, and I think that this, the show really shows a lot of, and it's just the tip, you know, to avoid a cliche and saying it anyways, it's just like the tip of an iceberg, a big gay iceberg.
Yeah, I mean, even as I was asking that question, I was like, you know, obviously now it's not just the village, like that would be kind of insulting almost. It is funny though that you say that there's this like activist history of the queer scene in Montreal, because that's something you see so clearly today. So it's really interesting that that's sort of long been the case too.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Like, I'm the student of history at Concordia, and I've taken some classes in history of Quebec because I live here, so I wanted to have more of a context. And Quebec in general has always been, you know, pretty politicized and activized and protesty. So it's not just the queer scene that's like that, but definitely it's the scene that suits the place where it's located.
I talk to people in all sort of sectors and say, why is it so much more active, like mobilization in Quebec? And yeah, the answer I get is like, well, because we're in Quebec.
Same but different, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But for folks who want to check out the show, what do they need to know? Where can they find you guys?
We're at the Archive Gay du Québec, which is down in the village. It's on Atitegen and VJ, pretty much. And the exhibition is open Tuesdays through Saturday from 1 to 5 p.m. We are just going on Christmas break, so it'll be open again in January. We would love to have people come check it out. Our first exhibition was last summer. We did an exhibition on ACT UP Montreal, the HIV/AIDS activist group. We had a pretty incredible turnout, so it's been pretty great to have kind of this transformation of an archive space into also an exhibition space. We're going to have some special events related to the exhibition as well, so if you go to the website and sign up for the mailing list, you can get information about that too.
Yeah, always a hot tip to sign up for the mailing list for sure. But yeah. you say that, you know, there might be more events like this on the horizon. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. It's an exhibition space now. So there's always going to be an exhibition there. We have some things coming up. And there's certain organizations in the city that also want to do historical exhibitions in that space. So it's just been a really nice kind of transformation to see, you know, an archival space is pretty traditionally kind of one thing. You know, you're surrounded by these file boxes. You're wearing white gloves. You're being very kind of tender with all of these objects and documents. And by doing shows, we're getting people coming through. You know, like with the last show, we hoped that we'd get 200-something people, and we had 1,100. So people are coming through. They're knowing about the archives. People are donating things because they're seeing these shows. People are coming and researching new things because they've learned about the archives through these shows. And it's just really, really helping that it's not just a quote-unquote archival space anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing to have these shows kind of bring new people into the archives and make them, yeah, more alive, I guess. So show is on now until March 2nd at 1000 Rue Atatakan in Gay Village.
That's it.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on CKUT. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
You're listening to CKUT broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bichel. The Common Front has announced the salary gains from the tentative deal they reached last week with the Quebec government. The Common Front is a coalition of unions in the public and parapublic sector, representing some 420,000 Quebecers. They've been negotiating for over a year and put the pressure on this fall with a series of strikes in education, healthcare, and social services. In an update published Wednesday, they confirm they've secured a pay increase of 17.4% over 5 years. It's below the projected rate of inflation over that time, according to provincial estimates, but well above the government's last December offer of 12.7%. The coalition also says that the agreement includes measures to protect purchasing power during its final 3 years, as well as improvements in working conditions. Preliminary details were initially published and then quickly taken down late in December. On Wednesday, the Common Front chose to republish the update, given that it's been circulating on social media in the days since. Unions are holding general assemblies to vote on the agreement, and more details are expected January 7th. I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening. And we are back live on air in studio. I'm here with Titouan and Eliza, and we have your first Off the Hour Friday of the year. My name is Jules Bijal, and you heard me in some of those clips that we just played. It's a slow start to the year, so we're going to be playing some of the stories I've been working on with the Local Journalism Initiative as we get a new start to 2024. But you just heard an interview with Mark Andrew Hamilton, one of the co-coordinators of the Gay Archives of Quebec's new show, which you should definitely check out, as well as a quick update on the Common Front Coalition of Unions that just signed a deal, an 11th hour deal with the provincial government preventing an unlimited general strike. So basically, before we go into a little bit more about union news, we're coming into 2024 with a couple of unions having been on either unlimited strike or periodic strikes in the fall. That's the Common Front, which is unions in health, social services, and education. That's also the FAE, which represents around 67,000 teachers in the province. It's a lot of the French teachers here in Montreal in the public system. And there's also the FIQ, which represents nurses. So looking at what some of the trends are, what we're seeing is that two big coalitions of unions or unions have signed deals with the province. So that's the FAE, the teachers there, as well as the Common Front. The Common Front, as you just heard, has released a couple of details about that tentative agreement, but it's still going back to membership that has to vote. The FAE, we don't know anything about what the teachers are getting really at this point, as members are still reviewing that agreement, but there is still going to be, you know, some changes on the horizon, obviously, in health healthcare. We're seeing Bill 15 just introduced before the end of session in December, using closure powers actually to end debate. This is a massive restructuring of healthcare in the province, pushed forward by Christian Dubé. And, you know, in education, we're seeing a back to school date of projected to be January 9th in the French system here in Montreal, but it's, you know, unclear yet how parents are going to have to pick up the slack, and teachers as well, as, you know, students have been out of the class in the French system for over 22 school days. That's, you know, over a month of time in total. And there's going to be a lot of catch up left to do. But there is one union, one major union that's been on strike this fall that has not yet reached a tentative deal with the province. And that is the FIQ, a nurses union. I spoke to Roberto Bamba, who is a spokesperson for the union, on one of our shows in December. So you can have a listen, hear more about what it is exactly that the union is asking for. You're listening to CKUT broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at CKUT.ca. The biggest nurses union in the province is on day two of a four-day strike. I've got FIQ spokesman Roberto Bombo on the line to talk about what the union is asking. All right, Roberto, I've patched you through. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks so much for chatting with me.
My pleasure.
Yeah, let's get right into it. What's the mood like on the picket lines? You know, this is another strike following some previous actions this fall from the FIQ. How are nurses feeling to be striking only a few weeks before Christmas holidays?
I've been on the picket lines roughly 18 hours a day. I was in Montreal today in the Montérégie area and the Laurentians as well. We're in our third cycle. Let's be very clear. No healthcare professional, be it a registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, respiratory therapist, or clinical perfusionist, wishes to be on the picket line. Our members are dedicated healthcare professionals that go above and beyond for the population of Quebec. Their prerogative is to provide quality care for the patients. Unfortunately, after over a year of collective bargaining with our government, with very little openness, they had no choice. So it was almost a unanimous vote. Almost 60,000 healthcare professionals voted at 96% to put in pressure tactics, which are these strike days like you're seeing. So we're in our third cycle, 4 days. In the second day, they're motivated, they're determined. Yes, it's cold outside. Let's be very clear. We can't change the weather. Yes, there's a loss of income. However, they're adamant that the government will have to improve their offers for a significant improvement in quality of care in terms of their working conditions and remuneration as well.
Yeah, so why don't you catch us up to speed? You said that, you know, obviously you've been at the bargaining table for a long time with the province. It's been over a year now, right?
Too long, unfortunately.
Yeah. What are some of the big things that the FIQ is asking for? And, I mean, obviously there's been some back and forth over the months. What's the government's response been like as well?
During the pandemic, our working conditions were baffled with ministerial decrees. So the government or the employers or the institutions, the Ministry of Health, got this feel where healthcare professionals are interchangeable. Day staff could be forced to work evening shifts. Evening shift could be forced to work night shift. Part-timers could be forced to work full-time. Everybody is forced to work weekends. Well, that's not the way to govern a healthcare system. A majority of our healthcare professionals work shifts, but it's not 100%, and it's fine. A majority of them, over 75%, work weekends. However, it's not 100%. And now what the government is trying to put in place, he wants greater flexibility. So that's one of the difficulties we're having in this round of bargaining. He wants healthcare professionals to be interchangeable. So even if I'll give you an example. A registered nurse works in a clinic, and the clinic is closed on weekends. So she works Monday to Fridays. She cares for her patients. She has a full caseload. While what they want and what they're expecting is that, while she has to go help units in the hospital setting every second or third weekend, which is totally ludicrous. So that's one of the major factors in terms of the government that they're requesting in this round of bargaining.
Yeah, I'm curious about that because this has been a persistent problem in nursing. I remember years ago, before the pandemic, nurses were saying, you know, we're being burned out, we're working all this overtime. But you're saying that things have been deteriorating in the last few years. Is that right?
Definitely. So the pandemic had a significant deterioration in the healthcare system. There's been an exodus of the healthcare professionals. So either they're leaving altogether for early retirement, or as soon as they're eligible to retire, they leave the public healthcare system altogether. If not, they're going and being hired through private agencies. So these are private companies that hire qualified healthcare professionals, and their sole purpose is to supply resources to the public healthcare system, which is also nonsense. So our taxpayers' dollars are paying a company for profit to staff the healthcare system. And why are people exiting the public and coming back via private enterprise? Is that way they could decide on their scheduling, and they could also decide in terms of their working conditions, be it remuneration as well.
Yeah, and I know that healthcare workers and you know, not just the folks at the FIQ, but in the Common Front as well, have been saying, you know, the privatization of our healthcare, whether it's with certain provisions in Bill 15 or just this increasing reliance on these contractors coming in is a concern. How have you seen the Legault government, I guess, positioning itself in terms of this file? Legault last week said basically it's unnatural or it's not normal that unions have so much power and managers have so little. Obviously, Christian Dubé, the health minister, has pushed through Bill 15 using censure powers this past weekend. You know, how do you in the healthcare sector see the Coalition Avenir Québec's approach to healthcare as a whole?
With regards to our Premier Legault, his comments put in the media, it's really to provoke the population to try to gain support. Let's be very clear. The unions are not managing the healthcare system. There's different levels of managers within the institutions, and they're responsible for administering and managing the healthcare system. So that's total nonsense. However, that's his choice to try to provoke public support and against the unions, because they're clearly seeing it in the surveys that the population is supporting the nurses, is supporting the teachers, the professors, public sector workers, and not supporting the government. So as for Bill 15, once again, it's going to be a huge reform. Every time that we bring in a new health minister, there seems to be a need to reform the healthcare system. We had it with the ministre Barrette in 2016-2017 with Bill 10. Well, it's not even 10 years and we're already going through another reform. Whenever we're merging these institutions, we're creating huge institutions. So it's really in terms of centralization of power, and there's nothing concrete that will benefit the patients or the population. We'd love to see in these 1,200 articles, how is it going to benefit the patients that are on a waiting list? We simply don't see it. All it is these mega mergers, and we're already having difficulties in terms of labor relations, in terms of scheduling, in terms of payroll with an employer with 20,000 employees. So could you imagine one employer with 350,000 employees? So it's going to be total chaos in that sense.
Yeah, and it's interesting the time that it's coming at, right? Because, as you say, combination of the pandemic and other factors just worsening in the system, we're seeing a mass exodus of healthcare providers and professionals. And the message that the FIQ has been putting out to the public is that, you know, your work conditions are Quebecers' care conditions. How are you seeing Quebecers, you know, respond to that? Do you think that people have a sense of, I guess, the difference that your demands would make in terms of the care that they would get day to day at a healthcare institution?
There's no quick fix solution. So let's be clear. So in this round of bargaining, we're bringing forward certain proposals that will improve. However, it will not fix the healthcare system. We've got to be very clear on that. There's been a deterioration in the last number of years. There's been an exodus. So from my viewpoint, it's quite clear. We need to attract the youth in this profession. So be it a registered nurse, a licensed practical nurse, a respiratory therapist, a clinical perfusionist, it's an excellent profession. If you have acceptable working conditions, we're not even aspiring to great working conditions. We just wish acceptable working conditions where a healthcare professional goes to work, does an 8-hour or 12-hour shift, she completes her shift, and she goes home and she feels like, what an excellent day I had today. And not going home or not being able to go home because of mandatory overtime, and then have this concern that I have sufficient time to provide all the adequate care I had to provide to my patients. Did I do adequate assessments in terms of physical assessments, in terms of psychological assessments? Did I have time to do it? And oftentimes, it's not the case. So in terms of the population, and I've seen it on the picket lines, I've been talking to patients, I've been talking to family members. They see nurses day in, day out, on the units, running around. It's not normal in this day and age. We're not in a pandemic no longer. We're in 2023. People should be able to have a normal work shift. So that's what we're trying to bring forward with certain of our measures, like ratios in terms of safe staffing ratios that we're putting forward in this round of bargaining.
Obviously, part of that demand, it's not just about working conditions, it's also about remuneration, because I believe Quebec's starting salaries for nurses are the lowest in Canada. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So one of the problems in our province is entry levels. So when you're in an employment like we're dealing right now in an economy that's running on all cylinders and you're in full employment, people have an opportunity to find work everywhere. Good paying jobs starting in $20, $25, $30 an hour. So if that's the starting wages, they will not tend to wish to work in the public sector for the starting wages of a registered nurse or licensed practical nurse.
Yeah, we've got about a minute left on the clock. So just briefly, what is next for the FIQ nurses? What are you looking towards? Because, you know, it's a 4-day strike, but we have yet to see how the government is going to respond and what new offers they'll put on the table.
Correct. So we've been at the bargaining table today. We'll see if it will intensify itself. My message is quite clear to the members. We're December the 12th. There's 12 days before Christmas, and I'm excluding Christmas. There's plenty of time for the government with his team, for them to give them clear mandates to progress this round of bargaining. And in 12 days, our teams are available 24 hours a day, and we could definitely reach an agreement in principle before Christmas. And if it's not before Christmas, we've never seen it in the past, but it could be done between Christmas and New Year's. Let's start 2024 with an agreement in principle and focus. Let's go back to work and let's not get into a fourth cycle in early January. So that's what the message I would share.
All right. Well, we will see. And all eyes will be on striking workers this week for sure. Roberto Bomba, thank you so much for joining me on CKUT.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, that was Roberto Bomba representing the Fédération Interprofessionnelle de la Santé du Québec, which is the province's largest nurses' union. And we are back live on air in our station, CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bugel, and I'm here with two members of our news collective, Eliza and Titouan, for your first off-the-hour Friday of 2024. We're going to close out the show with a little bit of conversation about something that across the street from us at McGill is worrying a lot of people. That's the Quebec government's hike for out-of-province tuition fees. They announced last month that they were going through with that for the fall term, but there is a few changes in the works, so take a listen, and we'll talk about it a little bit more after that plays. You're listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal, and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bugel. It's official. Starting next fall, out-of-province tuition for incoming students will rise to $12,000 a year, an increase of about a third. François Legault announced the change on Thursday after months of pledging an even bigger hike of $17,000. That the CAC government settled on a lower figure was little comfort to McGill and Concordia, who will bear the brunt of these changes now that Bishop's University has received a partial exemption. Here's McGill Principal Deep Saini speaking to reporters Thursday afternoon.
The measures that the government released today are devastating. They are far worse than those announced on October 13th, worse for Quebec, worse for its universities, worse for Quebec businesses who need talent, and worse for McGill.
Higher Education Minister Pascal Dury has said that McGill and Concordia will remain competitive despite the hike, but Saini says that's just not realistic.
If a student that starts with zero, French, has to go to level five, it would take equivalent of one full semester to learn that French, and that semester has to be distributed across their degree. Then we are saying to the students, you come to McGill, pay higher tuition, twice the tuition that you would pay at a competing university, University of Toronto or University of British Columbia, but you will have to stay one extra term. You can conclude from that very easily that no student that is thinking about their financial investment and the time it would take would choose to come to McGill. They would instead go to Ontario universities or elsewhere.
He's speaking here about a new requirement on top of the higher tuition. That's a French level 5, which 80% of students at Anglophone universities will need to obtain for the schools to avoid government penalties. That requirement, which is set to begin in fall 2025, was a surprise announcement that officials say will be difficult to reach. According to the government, level 5 is the first intermediate step where a speaker can have a conversation with varied vocabulary. Assessing it would require tests of oral comprehension and production, most likely through online testing software. Speaking to reporters this week, Mayor Valérie Plante says she's yet to hear a convincing rationale for the province's demands, and she's worried about what the changes will do to the city of Montreal.
I'm still worried, and I've been very vocal in supporting all the ecosystem of all the universities. And so for me, I want the government of Quebec to share with us why it's okay for Bishop not to have those rules and why it remains for the universities like McGill and Concordia, you know, internationally known institution. Why do they have to follow those lines?
For his part, Premier François Legault says it's a necessary measure to protect the French language. From 2016 to 2021, the census shows a 2.4% drop in French as the first language spoken at home in Montreal.
The reality, the facts are that when you look every year, the percentage of Francophones in Montreal, it's decreasing year after year since at least 20 years. So what I'm trying to do with them, and we're hoping for discussion, is to find ways to stop this decline. And I think it's
the increase in tuition fees will go towards the Francophone network of universities, who are less able to attract international students with higher tuition fees than counterparts like McGill. International students coming to Quebec will also see their fee structure change as the government claws back more of their tuition fees to redistribute among the Francophone network. Students from Belgium and France will be exempt. McGill Principal Deep Saini told the community last week, quote, "We must prepare to navigate very difficult waters ahead. The university is set to lose out on tens of millions of dollars as a result of the changes," which Saini calls incoherent.
"We categorically reject the position of the government. It is incoherent policy based on impressions and emotions rather than evidence-based decision-making."
But only time will tell what exactly will be affected. McGill and Concordia say they're already seeing a decrease in applicants from the rest of Canada. I'm Jules Bugel. Thanks for listening. All right, and we are back live in studio, to talk a little bit more about the story, which is obviously going to have an effect on all the folks who are currently at McGill, two of whom are in this room. So, one of the big things that changed since I did that particular radio story is the Canada Award, which has been introduced by McGill University. Does anyone want to take the floor on that?
Yeah, so as a little reminder, originally, the Quebec government wanted to increase their tuition to about 17K, and then they said that 12K would be the new number. And McGill has said that they would give an award to students that would be entering in the fall of 2024 and the winter of 2025 to offset this increase, and having the student that will be coming in these terms pay a share tuition that is more like what we pay now. That would mean that those students would be safe from their tuition increase for a couple of years.
Yeah. No, it's funny because it's we don't really know everything, and we know that they're going to be announcing more details of the award, but I did see somebody say on Twitter, like, oh, McGill is going to fundraise so well off of this. And a couple days later, like, I'm a McGill alum, and I got this email, the classic McGill fundraising email. And I do think it's going to appeal to people because, you know, a lot of people have been successful post-McGill and are going to want to support this. So even though the university is losing money, which we're going to hear more about in a few minutes, like all the cuts that McGill and Concordia and probably even Bishops are going to have to make, you know, there will be maybe more money coming in from alum, at least for like places like McGill to support this award. Eliza, I know you were like looking more at the different specifics. Like there's some little caveats and like details. It's not just like all students are going to get this 3K that will offset the tuition cost, is it?
Yeah. Specifically, the award is open to undergrads studying agricultural and environmental sciences, architecture, arts, education, music, nursing, and science. But notably, the School of Business and Engineering are not included on that list. And so it's definitely still going to have an impact financially on other students, other undergraduate students not in those listed programs. And it's currently only available to about 80% of undergraduate students.
Yeah. Coming in for the 2024-25 year as well. So we don't know yet if it's going to be renewed, right, Chichuan?
It wasn't very clear. I think it might be, the big question is whether it's going to continue throughout the studies of those upcoming students or if it's just for a year.
I think it's continuing through their degree. Like they have whatever it is, 4 or 5 years to do it. But it's like after this next year, this first cohort, like are students just going to foot the bill? Probably at some point,
probably.
Right?
Probably. That's a lot of money for even for McGill.
Yeah. Though, I mean, I was seeing some McGill sort of like, I don't know if they were profs or postdocs or lecturers or what they were, tweeting about, you know, oh, of course McGill can afford to give every new student or 80% of new students 3K, meanwhile, they're doing like a hiring freeze. They want to like lose all this staff by attrition. How is that going to work? And I guess the answer is there's different pools from money that they're pulling from. But as we're going to hear in a couple minutes, you know, McGill has put in place a hiring freeze. A lot of universities are having to make drastic changes. And, you know, faculty and staff are, maybe they're not going to be too happy about students being the ones who are being favored in this, while their colleagues are like leaving and they can't replace them with anyone.
And I guess the other big change that was announced in early December is the French requirement. So students will need to reach a level 5 by the end of their studies. So that's 5 on a scale that goes up to 12. So it's the start of the intermediate level, which would mean that those students would be able to at least understand the gist of a conversation on daily life, and they would have a certain varied vocabulary. So, I mean, we can say whatever we want about that, but it's Quebec, so I feel like it's important that students learn French. But the question is also, who's going to teach them?
Who's going to teach them? How long is it going to take? Like, early on, after the hikes were announced, McGill came out and said, we had millions that was invested in this new French education program for our students, but we don't have the budget to do it anymore. So, you know, it does seem a little bit like the Quebec government is using the stick and not the carrot. You know, in the story we just played, like, Deep Saini, who's McGill's principal, just said, who is going to be choosing McGill when... if they don't have good enough French, which, let's face it, most Canadians outside of Quebec do not, they're going to need to put in about a semester's worth of work to, like, get up to level 5. Meanwhile, they're also paying $3,000 more a year. Like, that's not insignificant.
Yeah. It would also be interesting to see how it varies across different programs, as if you do need to put in, for example, a semester to learn French, depending on, for example, engineering and science programs, not having as many electives potentially and having to just spend more time in school to complete that requirement would definitely add to the financial impact of this policy as well.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we also saw that just from the fact that the Quebec government initially wanted a $17,000 tuition, which is completely uncompetitive with like any school anywhere in Canada, unless you're going private. The first priority was just, I mean, not having Anglophones come to Quebec. That's really what it is. So that's, you know, that's their priority, and they're maybe softening that a little bit, clearly in some sense, but we'll see how it shapes up down the road.
Exactly, because also McGill extended its application deadline for international student by 15 days. Originally, the application were due by January 15. That's been extended to February 1st. So exactly, they need to figure out quickly what's going to happen next fall already, because applications are going to come quickly, and those students need to know what they're going to pay and what are the requirements. So it seems that some of the those questions are answered already with the McGill Award, and the French requirements starting only in 2025-2026. So yeah, that gives a bit of a bit more certainty for students that will be coming this fall.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, one last thing is, like, the Quebec government is saying, okay, 80% of Canadian, like, Anglophone, or I think it's even international Anglophone students, out-of-province Anglos are going to have to reach level 5 French starting in 2025. Those guys, by the end of their degree, will have to hit this benchmark. Like, who knows? That's so many years down the line. Who knows what it's actually going to be by then? But there's this question of, like, how how are they going to make that work? Like, what 80% will it be? The consequence for not meeting that is McGill will get money, and Concordia as well will get money clawed back. Bishop's University is the third university in this conversation, having a lot of out-of-province, out-of-country students, mostly out-of-province for Bishop's. They're not going to get the financial penalties, and they get a partial exemption of, I believe, 825 students who can be sort of grandfathered in the old, like, tuition funding model. But it's all very piecemeal. Like, who are those 825 people going to be? Who's going to be this 80%? These will all be things that will have to be figured out by the leaders at these institutions. And we'll see what that looks like in the meantime. But we have a piece from earlier in December before all these details emerged, and it's talking with various folks at McGill, both students and faculty members, about how those tuition hikes are going to affect their experience at the university. Take a listen. You're listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bugel. On Friday, McGill Provost Christopher Manfredi announced an immediate hiring freeze of both academic and administrative staff. It's a response to the Quebec government's increase in out-of-province tuition costs, which will nearly double for undergrad and non-thesis master's students next fall. The government's also changing the funding model for international students, and both measures are going to see more of the university's revenues go to the government. The stated aim is using that funding for Francophone institutions. In last Friday's statement, Christopher Manfredi wrote that the goal was to reduce staff through attrition rather than layoffs. Exempted from those measures are teaching assistants, research assistants, course lecturers, and postdocs. Now, universities increasingly are relying on contract lecturers, who lack the protections and pay that tenured staff enjoy. With a ban on new hires, it's likely this trend will continue. Concordia, meanwhile, is freezing non-academic hiring and executive salaries. It's also cutting the budget by 7.8%. The day before the announcement, about 100 students and supporters gathered on McGill campus to protest the government's decision. One of those was Joseph Liang, who's an undergrad in the Schulich School of Music, where the tuition hikes will have a big impact on the student body. Here he is now.
Obviously, like from the email from the principal, the School of Music is going to be probably one of the most hard-hit faculties. Like, almost half of our population is international or out of province, and so it's going to significantly change the proportion of undergraduate students in the School of Music and also reduce our funding for next year. And so it means that, like, we're not able to hire new staff, and a lot of, like, programs and stuff are going to be put on hold. And so it's going to be pretty interesting, because right now the undergraduate community and culture at Schulich is really vibrant, and that's not really something that we want to lose.
Liang is a Music Student Society exec, and in that role, he's been active in rallying students against the hikes. He says that although people are concerned, the message that the school won't close has allayed some of their fears.
I think there's concern. I don't think people are as scared. Like, I don't think that because the Schulich School of Music's not going to shut down, I don't think people are scared of, like, losing that. So I don't think it's, like, the vibe's not that off, but I think people are still concerned about it, and I think, yeah, they're still going to be, like, opposed to the policy, yeah.
Around 40% of music students are out-of-province Canadians. That means it's students like Liang, who came to McGill in part because of a competitive funding package that Quebec's going to lose if they go through with the hikes.
So McGill's music program is, like, one of the top ranked in the country. There's, like, a really strong music culture here as well, so there's just so many opportunities to get involved. A lot of students at Schulich contribute to the broader Quebec and Montreal community in terms of, like, playing at gigs. We have jazz combos that play at different clubs and stuff. And so a lot of these students actively give back to Montreal, and so by kind of excluding a lot of those people from out of province, you also lose a lot of the culture and music that is brought to Montreal by the Schulich School of Music.
And it's not just music. McGill's agricultural programs will also see austerity measures from the tuition hikes. Here's Anya Geitman, Dean of the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences and Associate Vice Principal for McDonald Campus.
Well, everybody's very disconcerted, right? If the tuition is hiked to the level that the government proposed originally, $17,000 per year, it means that many, if not all, our students from the rest of Canada would not be able to come to McDonald or to our programs anymore, or would not choose to, because the program becomes twice as expensive as comparable programs at other Canadian universities. The portion varies every year, but it is about 20 to 24%, anywhere in between there. So it could be a fifth to almost a fourth of our undergraduate population, which is significant. And this has actually huge ramification because our programs are, of course, rather costly to deliver. We have a lot of hands-on programming labs. We have teaching infrastructure that is costly to operate, such as a farm or a food pilot plant, engineering operations. And if we lose a critical mass of students, we might not be able to operate all these infrastructures anymore. So even the students, and including the Quebec students that join us, would suffer because the quality of our programming would suffer because we simply wouldn't be able to operate our costly teaching infrastructure anymore.
Like with the Faculty of Music, Geitman says the changes at McDonald campus could have ripple effects throughout the province. Here she is again.
Since the university doesn't know yet what exactly will come down from the government, it has slowed down certain decisions. So, for example, a new pilot plant for the Departments of Food Science and the Departments of Bioresource Engineering has been literally put on ice for now. And that has dramatic consequences for our ability to train people for the sector in which Quebec is looking, scrambling for qualified personnel, and that is the food transformation sector. We know exactly that there is a huge lack of qualified personnel in that area. And so if we are not able to build these new infrastructures or deliver the programs with the hands-on experience that is necessary in order to train people in that sector, Quebec will suffer.
The students are feeling this too. Kayla Ravinsky was at Thursday's protest. She's expecting the school's reputation to suffer as it scrambles to make up for the drop in revenue.
I mean, again, I think it's hard to stay now without seeing it happen in practice, but I think you are going to see a reduction in university. I think McGill is going to definitely plummet in rankings of, you know, how good of a university is. It's not going to have as much funding. It's not going to have as many people attending the school, graduating. So it's going to definitely lose a lot of its reputation. And it's definitely going to hurt Quebec society in that way, because it definitely is one of the best, not only in Quebec and Canada, but in the world. And by doing this, you're defunding our school. And
even though she doesn't know what protests or petitions will bring, Ravinsky says it's important for students to stand united in the face of these hikes.
Honestly, I'm not 100% sure how effective this will be, but it's worth trying. You know, I want people to be aware that we are not going to accept this without at least some kind of fight. We want to show our anger. Even the Université de Montréal is against this, as well as other French universities, UQAM, UDEM. So this is not just an isolated incident between a few English universities. This is province-wide, especially as people who are Quebec and first language French, they come here and they're against it as well, because learning from a prestigious school like this, you know, it opens up so many more opportunities. It helps, you know, strengthen bilingualism, and by just letting him get away with this without any type of fight, you know, it shows that we are weak and we don't care. And I don't want people to think of us like that.
Last week, a petition with over 33,000 signatures was tabled at the National Assembly. It called on the government to cancel the increase in tuition fees imposed on international and Canadian students not residing in Quebec. In response to the pushback, the province is said to be considering raising out-of-province fees to just $12,000 instead of the $17,000 originally tabled. But that will still be a big jump for incoming students to pay. And the CAC isn't budging on its changes to international tuition, which will see more revenue going away from universities and into the hands of the province. I'm Jules Bijal with files from Wendy Zhao and help from Eliza Lee. Thanks so much for listening.
Yeah.
So yeah, with that basis of like, oh yeah, cool, I am a good person, and like, how do I share my goodness and my compassion with everybody else and bring it to the real world?
Yeah.
And to do that, you have to get to know yourself, and you just have to sit.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that was such a beautiful way to end, I think, like, awesome. Wrap up our entire segment. That was so awesome. We're basically good. Yeah. And yeah, I feel like there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of like negative connotations around like empathy and how empathy can be seen as a weakness, but like really it's a strength.
It's an amazing thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like
how you actually connect with people and have a human relation.
Yeah. Which is pretty important as a human being, just a girl in a world. Wow. Usually we end with a song, but we've just been chatting.
We
could chat for hours. That was Panacea.
That was awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Ben, for sharing your wisdom. This is CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'll see you guys from 5 to 6 p.m. today, but usually that's not a thing. And next month, we're going to have a segment on major depressive disorder to celebrate our one-year anniversary. Bye.
Too tight, rent too high. Sometimes I feel like a nationless child. This blues a prayer, a song for Africa, a song for Malcolm, a song for our mother, a song for our future. Our future is a ballad for our children. Let them rest. Let them rest in melodies of peace. Come Sunday, we may all be singing Attica blues. We may all be singing Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. Fire is and was the way ahead. On this night, we going home. On this night, we going home. We going home. Crossing.